Good morning, DEF CON. Can I get a sign of life out there? Anything? Alright, how's Friday night treating y'all? Indeed. Why do you think I'm wearing sunglasses? DEF CON 12 is pleased to present Mr. Doug Mone, former employee number 10 of DigX. Who has heard of DigX? Anyone? Give it up for DigX. Alright. And without further ado, Mr. Doug Mone.
Now, are you showing me your pocket or your ass?
Get off.
I show you the waistband.
All right, I don't need to. Things we don't need to know. Yes, welcome to Las Vegas, the only city where you can go like this, and they think you're shooting craps rather than something else. Good morning. My name is Doug Mone, as KK introduced me. I was employee number 10 at DigX. I started at DigX in October of 1993. I was with DigX from 1993 until about middle of 1997. Sometimes the memories get rusty because of old age, and sometimes because I'm repressing them. What will I cover in today's talk? I want to talk a little bit about DigX history circa 1993-1994. To give you a perspective of that, I need to talk a little bit about internet history, the infrastructure back then versus the way it is today. There are a lot of things that we take for granted, like DSL and cable modems and other fast shit that just didn't exist back then. And let me tell you something, Sonny. And then talk about the first commercial web servers or services that were offered by DigX and basically offered by anybody on the planet at that time. Talk a little bit about the secret history, for lack of a better term, of MTV.com, CIA.gov, and PETA.org. Why should you care? Well, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. You know, a lot of the times you see lessons in history where stuff happens, and then 10 years later, it's the same sort of situation. It's only a different industry, or the players are a little bit different, or the companies are a little bit different. DigX literally started out in Doug Humphrey's basement in 1991, and he grew the company through a mixture of technical acumen, luck, and riding the internet wave into a company that went through an initial public offering in 1996. Was bought out by CLEC Intermediate Communications in 1997. Intermedia saw DigX, the web hosting side of DigX, rolled it around a little bit, spun it off as an IPO again in 1999, a mere 2 years later after they bought it. Towards the end of DigX's lifespan, it was bought by WorldCom for billions before the dot-bomb hit. And some of the history that we saw back then, we're starting to see again today with the emergence of the wireless internet service providers and some of the other wireless plays that are happening. Significant early contributions we can attribute to DigX, not to DSR or UUNET. DigX was the first company to offer a commercial type of web server hosting business. It wasn't IBM, it wasn't EDS, it was DigX. MTV.com, the first entertainment web server, went on the internet in 1993, and then things that we attribute to the Al Gore, why attribute to the Al Gore gold rush, a lot of the government agencies like in the executive branch, including CIA, had to run out and go get web servers, and of course PETA. DigX's founders. DigX was started by two friends, who became friends in college, Doug Humphrey and Mike Downey. Doug Humphrey was a hacker, not by trade, but basically for fun. He found his way to MIT, the time-sharing service, along with a lot of other people back in the 80s. His handle there was DigX, short for Digital Express Group. He later went on to University of Maryland, and even at U of M, he was a practicer of the arts of phone phreaking. Well, I shouldn't say practicer. Collector of information of the arts of phone phreaking. He organized a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1980. It was called Watts 80, play on the Watts 800 number lines. And then he also attended DEF CON over the years. And then his day job, when he started up DigX, he was an engineer for Tandem Computer Corporation. Doug's a big guy. He's probably like, you look at Priest and you think Doug Humphrey, and I often think to myself, I wonder who could take who in a fight, Priest or Doug Humphrey, because Doug's a big guy. Doug also sometimes packs a 45, so it would be an interesting fight. Mike Downey, on the other hand, is a smaller guy. Maybe he's about a little bit taller than KK, the guy who introduced me here. Mike's path in life started out with radio. He was at University of Maryland. He started up the WMUC radio station at U of MD. Later ended up on WorldCom IDB, that is the satellite head side of WorldCom. And he was stationed over all the Gulf War in 1991. And he was babysitting communications links between Central Command in the Gulf and the Pentagon. And the line that the Air Force, well, not the Air Force, but Central Command gave all the contractors there was, don't worry, we'll get you out before the shooting starts. So it turns out that one night in January, they hear the planes roll off the airfields en masse, all their all the lights turned off, and they run up to their DOD liaison, and they go, it's just a rehearsal, right? DOD guy goes, yeah, it's just a rehearsal, don't worry about it, go back to work. And then somebody ran in like a half hour later going, look what's going on CNN, they're shooting CNN. Downey was a little bit, shall we say, perturbed by that, because his post was sitting basically, was in a trailer on top of the command bunker for Central Command. So if the Iraqis got lucky with a scud or managed an attack, that was like one of the primary targets. Mike tried to get an airplane ride out of Saudi Arabia, but he couldn't get a plane ride for like 3 days since all commercial flights were shut down. But you know, when the Gulf War started, he said, "Well, I'd like the pay, but I didn't sign up for this." He resigned his position and grabbed the first transport flight he could get out of to go home. This is Doug Humphrey. Anybody seen him? Anybody know him? Know him? Seen him? Yes, no? Don't want to admit it? Okay, that's fine. Digix was started by Doug and Mike Downey, but there are like three other supporting characters that you may know, or two that you may know of that are in the community or were in the DEF CON community at one time or another. Rob R.S. Seastrom provided some of the first hardware and brought up the first Digix's first dial-up system. RS the next year would be hired by Intercon Software and go off to start the first commercial internet link in Japan. Rob Stratton did some of the first email builds for Digix, and it was a guru on some of the initial concepts on how to get the system set up and running. Strat went on to UUnet. And from UUnet, he started up Wheel Group, sold it off for a good bundle, and now he's working at InQtel. Everybody knows what InQtel is? Yes, now? Yeah, the CIA's venture fund. That's a job I'd like to have. Before 1993, Digix started up in 1990. Digix was going to be an email exchange. Back in the early days, everybody was an island. AOL, MCI, CompuServe, they all had different email services, but nobody could talk to each other. Digix was going to sit in the middle of all of these different email services and basically act as an intermediary, as Switzerland, if you will, so people could exchange email. The internet dial-up business started up as a sideline. They needed some cash to pay the bills. So they started up the system in September 1991 with six phone lines. And by the end of 1993, they had accumulated, you know, a little bit less than a year. They had over 2,000-plus users, 100-plus dial-up lines, leased line customers, dedicated slip and PPP customers, and they were also doing web hosting. Now, this picture that you see on the screen is a picture of Digix's home on the second floor. Above the Beijing Inn, or as I like to say, above the Chinese restaurant as the gods intended, that's where Digix was. Across the way, there was a 7-Eleven, so we had 24/7 access to Munchies and Big Gulps. A lot of our guys, when they did work, they described work in terms of Big Gulps. If it was like a 2 or 3 Big Gulp night, you knew it was a bad night. Now and then, just as a snapshot, you look at the technology back then versus what we've got today, and I don't want to sound too much like a codger, but I mean, there's so much more capacity today, both in your home and in the ground. It really is amazing if you stop and think about it. Back in the day of 1994, the elite thing was the 28K modem. Today, you've got DSL, you've got cable. If you're a really poor bastard, you've got a 56K modem, if nothing else. Back then, there was a T3 network run by ANS, and that was it. Nobody else was running T3s back then for internet connectivity. Today, it's kind of like almost passe if you don't have any, if you've got anything less than an OC48, if you're running a national internet IP-based network. And then some people have even gotten wedged up to OC192. Today, you can get yesterday, you had to get T3s delivered on fiber. Today, with a little hardware magic, you can practically get a T3 delivered to your house on a handful of dry copper pairs. Fiber then was rare. Today, you basically got fiber to the home. Well, almost. But you know, if you live in a country club, if you live in a newly built country club type of complex, there's a good chance that they might have fiber in the ground, and fiber also installed to the home. Again, you know, back then you had to explain to people what a web page was. Today, your grandma's got a web page. You know, today, back then, Wired was the in thing, the new thing, the hip thing, and now Wired's like mainstream. Does anybody still read Wired? Yeah, a couple people. Wired was much cooler back 10 years ago. Is there anybody who's writing for Wired in the audience? Okay. Infrastructure snapshot. What did the internet look like back then? There was one backbone. It was run by NSFNet, a government grant that was operated by ANS, Advanced Network Systems, basically a conglomerate of IBM and MCI, is a T3 high-speed network. As the contract for NSFNet ran down, the educational-based network, ANS received permission to sell commercial services as a part of the transfer of internet network operations out of the government and into the private sector. For everybody else, the T1, that 1.54 megabit per second pipe, was a big deal. Both PSINet and UUNet, the two largest guys who were running internet backbones at the time, had national T1 backbones. They didn't have T3, couldn't afford it, didn't have enough traffic to justify it in most cases. Digex, and this is like the first piece of secret knowledge that few people know about, got a T1 backdoor deal from ANS. ANS had a seed program called Diamond Mine, where they wanted to stimulate the growth of commercial traffic on their newly emerging commercial network. So they had this deal where if you asked the right people and you begged hard enough, you could get a free T1 for 12 months. And back then, T1s were like thousands of dollars. So this was a great deal. So Doug Humphrey went to ANS and wheeled and controlled, and he finally got a T1 out of ANS through this seed deal. And of course, we all liked it because it fit in with Digix General number one, which Doug liked to repeat often to us just to make sure that we tried to do it. If you wanted to do business with us, you have to give us something for free. You got a T3. So we got a T1 from ANS. You know, we loved ANS. Two key characters coming up towards 1993 as the company grew. They hired two systems people, Ed Kern. Ed Kern's a one-time doorman for the 930 Club, basically a club down in Washington, D.C. And then Ed Kern also had some ties to three-letter agencies, but every time I asked him questions about that, he'd shut up. Ed Kern got a job at Digix because he was a dial-up customer in 1992, and he'd often call up Doug and bitch about the service. And tell him that he needed to fix this or that. And finally, the two of them sat down and it got into this discussion, and they had an agreement reached where Ed would get root running the Digix dial-up systems as a systems admin, and ultimately got a job out of it. Ed's a very interesting character. Even today, I think he still wears sweats and Birkenstocks. Rain or shine, snow, summer, doesn't matter. I think his only concession to fashion and the weather is in the winter he'll put socks on before he puts on his Birkenstocks. And fuck was his major vocabulary word. Dave McGuire was a systems programmer and hardware savant, for lack of a better term. Dave engineered some of the hardware for the first commercial web server. I want to give Dave props because Dave's one of these like quiet guys you don't hear a lot about, but he was slaving away in the back room for the first 2, 3, 4 years of Digix just making sure the systems ran. He's one of those guys who had the 2 and 3 super big gulp nights. Pictures of Ed and Dave. Ed on the left is a guy pointing at the camera. He's probably going, don't take my fucking picture. The guy next to him in the suit and tie is a guy named Peter Lothberg. Does that ring a bell? No? All right, never mind. And the guy with a happy smile on his face on the right, that's Dave McGuire. That's not his girlfriend, but he's still happy. Digix in 1993. When I joined the company in October, it had 10 whole people. By December, it had risen up to 20 people on payroll. One of the biggest battles Digix had to fight was with the RBox. The phone companies did not get it in terms of the internet, the potential for growth, the potential for them to make money. When we were above the Chinese restaurant, we wanted desperately to get fiber optic cable. Fiber enabled people to, number one, deliver T3 type of service, which was very, very important. You needed to have speed. And number two, in order to get any sort of massive dial tone, you also needed fiber in. Now, one of the other dirty little secrets is that Digix had gone up to 40 dial-up lines, 40 inbound dial-up lines, and we maxed out all the copper in Greenbelt. Local residents couldn't get second phone lines at all within the city limits of Greenbelt. We had sucked up all the excess copper. More importantly, from our perspective, some of the lines that we had gotten were these substandard crummy guy lines that were like marginal, best case, for delivering voice. So if somebody would try to do a 28.8K data connection on them, and there'd be crap on it, and then kick down to like 2,400 baud, and they call us up and they bitch. It was a bad situation. We finally had to go to Bell Atlantic's engineers and go, well, what do we have to do in order to get fiber in here? And the guy we got to was a straight shooting engineer. He goes, look, just order like 80 lines, and they'll have to put in the fiber. They won't have any choice in the matter, because once you order the service, by tariffs and by right, they have to deliver the service. So we sat and we placed an order for like 80 phone lines in the month of December, and then we wanted another 80 phone lines in the month of January. Didn't know how we were going to pay for them, but we had to order them anyways. Our sales rep was very, very happy, but the Bell Atlantic engineers were not, because once they saw that order placed, they figured that they had to pull fiber from the local central office down to the above the Chinese restaurant, and that was something that, you know, they weren't just, it just didn't fit in their worldview. One of the other things that didn't fit in their worldview was our was how much sales revenue and how much telecommunications capacity was flowing through our small business rep. A typical small business rep for Bell Atlantic, you know, maybe sells a handful of lines a year, some Centric service. If they're really, really lucky, they'll sell to a business, they'll sell a 56K lease line. Our rep was showing up every month, and she's like putting down 20, 30, 40 orders for phone lines every month, and 51s and 56Ks and all that stuff. She made a lot of money. And just as an annoyance factor, you know, we were driving all this business for Bell Atlantic, and other ISPs around the country were driving all this business for the RBox, but they never sent us any thank you notes. It's very interesting because a lot of the popularity of the internet as it rose over the years did drive a lot of installations of second lines and third lines into households. Digix's competitors at that time, or the evil triangle as it were, PSINet over in Northern Virginia. PSINet had basically started out by the guys who ran NYSERNet went off, started up their own private company, and basically said, well, if you don't hire us, we're not going to maintain NYSERNet, so it'll go down. For some reason, PSI got the contract after that. UUNet at that time was 20 to 30 people. They were over in Falls Church, Virginia. UUNet started out as a nonprofit to distribute software, and as the internet evolved, UUNet became like the gold standard that everybody got compared to, since UUNet had been the ones offering lease lines the longest, and they had better technical support than PSINet. And then we also had to deal with Surinet, which was run out of the University of Maryland. Basically, it was a part of the old NSFNet. They were a regional consortium running a part of the NSFNet. First commercial web hosting, first commercial server hosting, was cooked up in the summer of 1993. Back then, people wanted a net presence. Even back then, there were certain organizations that wanted a net presence, but they didn't want to have to deal with the overhead of operating a server on the internet. They didn't want to have to deal with the headaches of phone company, Unix management, TCP/IP network management. So the ideal solution was, you know, why do we have to do it? We'll just outsource it to somebody else. Second thing became all hardware. Well, okay, if we're going to go ahead and create these web server things and run them for people, we want to be able to have, we want to be able to put a lot of these servers into a relatively small space. So Dave McGuire did this hardware hack, and he got a VME chassis and got a hold of a couple of Sun 360 board workstation boards and managed to do this hardware hack where the VME chassis would provide power to the Sun boards. And he was able to fit 12 boards into a chassis. They would do remote boot via Ethernet, disk access via Ethernet. But it was funny because we went and we talked to Sun, and Sun was like, well, no, you can't do that. And then, 2 weeks later, Dave has this situation where we're running running this hardware, basically on this hack. The cool thing about it was Sun, the 360 boards at the time were dirt cheap. Sun was getting out of the Sun 3 business. They were spinning up Spark. They were spinning up something else. So they were dumping Sun 3s off of their own desktops. We didn't have to do dumpster diving. There was somebody who was a friend of the company who basically went around and said, you're getting rid of your workstation? No, I'll take it down to the dumpster for you. And he ended up, walked down, stick it in his car, and then 2 days or 3 days later, you drive over and we'd have, more 360s to play with. It wasn't illegal. I mean, the equipment was surplus and scheduled to go into hardware anyways, but it had a few more fingerprints on it than I'd be comfortable with. Presage blades, the thing that Dave put together, presaged the concept of server blades by, 5 years. The hack that he put together was very nice. You could put a lot of servers into a compact space. You had fewer plugs. You didn't have to worry about one plug per workstation, and you didn't have to worry about shelves. Solutions up until that time, before David worked at this hardware hack, was one workstation dedicated to a customer, one server. So you basically had a rack mount, this kludgy business where you had a rack with shelves on it, and clunk, 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 wire, wire, wire. Why was this good? Well, from business perspective, PSI and UNIT were all focused on pipes. Leased lines was the name of the game. That's what they wanted to sell. Web hosting, or private domains as we called them, were for people who didn't want to dork with Unix or didn't want to dork with management headaches involved in terms of internet management. The cool thing about that was once that DigiX got a lot of servers generated, set up, it generated a lot of internet traffic coming into the company that we could leverage for the future. There was a discussion that the internet would evolve into something like the telephone company where at someday down the road, you have to deal with settlements like you deal with telephone settlements now where if I do 1,000 minutes and you do 2,000 minutes and if I exchange 1,000 minutes and you exchange 2,000 minutes, then somebody's going to have to pay the difference of 1,000 minutes to me. Settlements didn't come to the internet. Instead, you had a situation of peering where if you generated enough traffic, you were considered a big boy on the internet and you had direct connections between ISPs. But more importantly, it made DigiX a place to be because we had a lot of cool servers that we put up in 93. And finally, it made money. I junked up Sunboard. It cost us nothing. And, the cost of electricity to basically keep it up and running was relatively low overhead. Initial customers. The very, very first commercial very, very first company that paid for a web host, the American Library Association. We usually associate librarians as being prey to the paper, et cetera, but the American Library Association wanted to have user.ala.wash.org for their email addresses. It was very important to them. And this was all the more phenomenal to us because at that time nobody knew what the hell a World Wide Web was anyways. It was a World Wide what? You know, you go into major companies and you have to spend 20 minutes explaining to them what the internet was. ALA, the American Library Association, got it. The second customer, one of the customers that followed along shortly thereafter was MTV.com. And MTV.com was the very first entertainment type of host or entertainment type of server on the internet. And it was something that freaked the net purist out badly. Now I want to talk to you about somebody else who, how many of you remember Adam Curry from MTV? Okay, I see, oh yes, cool. Adam Curry is somebody I call the internet Cassandra, and I'll get into the reason why after that. Adam is the third guy on the left with the joint in his mouth. Third guy from the left. Adam Curry was a network pioneer. His day job, he was a VJ at MTV every Friday without fail, and it was a top 20 video countdown. And in those days, MTV was really cool for me. Now I'm old, I watch VH1. I love the 80s. But I mean, you know, every Friday it was like, okay, got to get home and see what the hot videos are. And Adam was the man who introduced those videos. But Adam was a closet geek. He had an account on, he had a dial-up account on Panax. And one of the first things he did with his, and he looked at the internet and he started playing around with the internet and technology. And one of the first things he did was, since he was tied in with all of these entertainment people at MTV, he developed his a gossip column that he called Cyber Sleaze, and he distributed it using the internet. And first he sent it out through email, but it quickly grew to the point where it was too much of a pain in the ass for him at that time to maintain an email mailing list. So he goes, well, I'm going to take my gossip column. It's only text. Well, that's the only thing anybody had in those days anyways. And I'm going to stick it in my plan file. And then just let everybody know that they can see my weekly gossip column online. So he sticks it in his plan file. And I'm not really a Unix people, but plan has a certain amount of overhead. And when you multiply that out by a couple hundred people around the world fingering you to look at your plan file, the overhead dragged Panax to its knees. The owner of Panax gets on the phone to Adam, and I'm not exactly sure what was said, but it was something like, you asshole, you don't know what you're doing. What the fuck do you think you're doing? You know? And the Panax guy basically said, I don't want you on my system anymore. And Adam said, well, where do I go? And he's like, well, I think there's some dumb company down in Greenbelt that might do business with you, so why don't you go talk to them? So Adam Curry calls us up, and I wasn't the sales guy, but the sales guy I know basically... you know, gets on the phone and it's like, is this really Adam? Yeah, it's really Adam Curry. And within like 10 minutes, we had his Amex information, which, of course, is priceless. In short order, he was placing an order for us for a web server. Now, Adam Curry did not actually have the rights to MTV.com, but Adam Curry registered, got into this big discussion with Viacom before he registered the domain name MTV.com. Viacom, because they were cable people, cable blinders, Viacom wanted to do a pay-per-view model on the internet. And Adam's like, no, that's not going to work. People aren't going to pay for you because the internet's new and there's a lot of free stuff. And Viacom's like, pay-per-view. And finally, Adam bugged him enough that Viacom agreed to loan him the MTV.com domain name for an experiment. Because after all, Adam was spending all the money for setting up the server, operating it, putting up the content. Adam was investing a lot of time and money to set up the server. So Viacom's like, yeah, you want to spend your own time and cash, it's fine. So MTV.com, the domain name got registered and put up, and then immediately on the internet there was a whole big discussion on what this was going to mean to the future of the internet. The academic uber geeks, that is the spoiled guys who never paid a dime for their internet access, were afraid of the commercialism of this site corrupting the purity of the internet. There are a lot of emails flying back and forth about how this was bad and how marketing was going to come in and advertising was going to come in the internet and it was going to ruin everything. But, you know, it didn't bother Adam. Adam's like, you know, fine, it's my own money. I'm going to do what I want. Once we got MTV online, people started hammering away at it. And one of the most popular things was, you know, trying to figure out the passwords for Beavis and Butthead. First day that MTV came online, it got 50,000 hits, which, you know.
Yeah, my website gets 50,000 hits in 2 days, man.
But that, you know, with only 600-plus web servers online in 1993, 50,000 hits a day was basically the most popular site on the Internet. And then as Adam added more content, MTV became a destination site on the Internet. And then that server and other servers put DigiX among the top traffic movers, people coming in and looking at stuff on the Internet. At one point, DigiX was listed as like number 5 in terms of most bits moved around, with the wall.unix CD distribution being like number 1. Like I said, Curry was a man before his time. Curry had this cushy job. Let's face it for a minute. The beautiful guy gets up every day, comes in every Friday, talks about videos. He's making a ton of money. He's meeting rock stars. Women are throwing themselves at him. Well, I'm assuming that. You know, one day he just walked off of his job, his VJ job at MTV, and he said, "I'm going to go do this internet thing." And then on a Monday morning, Howard Stern is making fun of Adam Curry, saying what kind of a dumb schmuck he is, you know. And but Adam didn't care. So I'd like to refer to Adam as a Cassandra of the internet. He was one of the first people to talk about putting music online, intellectual property rights with music. But when he was having those discussions, nobody really paid attention until much, much later. Ultimately, Adam got to the point where MTV.com became so popular that Viacom decided they wanted it back. And there was a very ugly situation where nobody had really established the rights as to who owned the Viacom name. And there were lawsuits, threats, blah, 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 and it finally got settled very quietly out of court. But I don't really cry for Adam because the companies that he founded made like a couple $100 million being sold as it was sold off. So Adam took the money, went off to Amsterdam. He married a model. He literally did marry a model. And now he's living happily ever after in a castle in the Netherlands. Adam's got a saying that's on his blog that I think is very appropriate for DEF CON. There are no secrets, only information you don't yet have. Now, if we leave the commercial world, the other thing that drove web servers at the time was Al Gore. I know that Gore was, you know, I'm not going to get into you. Did Gore claim to be the father of the internet? Well, not. But Gore did do something that was very, very important for driving the growth of the internet. And he had this initiative called Reinventing Government. And one of the mandates he put out to the executive branch of government was, "Thou shall get on the internet by the fall of 1994. Or I'll kick your ass." Well, he didn't say that, but it was implied. Now, if you take a look at the three branches of government, there's the Supreme Court, there's Congress, and the executive branch. Well, the Supreme Court doesn't spend a whole lot of money. While Congress allocates money, operationally wise, Congress doesn't spend a lot of money except on themselves and perks. So the bulk of the money that's spent is the executive branch. The bottom line at all, there were a lot of agencies over the summer of 1994 that were running around trying to figure out how to get on the internet to make Al Gore happy. And if memory serves, how many of you guys are feds and know? Oh, okay. The federal fiscal year closes out on September 30th. So there are a lot of people with excess funds sitting in their accounts that they needed to spend out by the end of the fiscal year. So it became a very big windfall for young internet companies. And I was personally involved with CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, getting on the internet, as well as a government agency called CIA.gov. CIA.gov is a very, very interesting thing. Is anybody from the CIA representing them? Not that you'll admit it, but okay. The Central Intelligence Agency didn't really want to be officially hooked up on the internet as kind of something that they were going to do to make Al happy. If you dug around into various bits and pieces on the internet, the who is implied that they had a T1 via Uninet, maybe a T1 via ANS, but nobody was really sure, and those who knew weren't really talking that loudly. The CIA knew that their website would become a hot target. Anybody, you know, I cracked CIA.gov, man. I mean, it was something that was going to definitely be attacked and would make the bones for somebody. There was also some tension between the old guard and the new guard. That is, people who were old-time CIA employees versus, like, some of the young people that had come in with the Gore administration and were pushing the new technology. There was some tension, but there wasn't a lot of tension. So the CIA wanted to get a presence on the internet to get Al off of their back. For them, outsourcing was the most logical solution. They didn't want to have the web server in-house. And unfortunately, Digex was the only game in town. Everybody else did not comprehend web serving, server hosting at all. PSI did not do it. UUNET did not do it. IBM would have done it, but it would have been a $1 million contract and taken 3 years. Same with EDS. You know, hey, well, you know, for less than $1,000 a month, we'll host a Sun 4 server for you. One of the big jokes was that security, there would be an air gap the size of the Beltway. CIA is located in Langley, Virginia. Well, Langley, Virginia would be over here. And then we were over in Greenbelt, and that distance was about 50 miles. So they liked the size of that air gap a lot. Yeah?
EDS didn't actually discover the internet until Gates invented it in 95.
Yeah, so you know what I'm saying. Yeah, but you know, 1994, we were happy to take the government's money. And I'm going to tell you a story about Mike Downey and PETA. Mike Downey is the guy on the left, not on the right. You'll notice a T-shirt that he's wearing. It's a T-shirt that says it's called the Digex Files. A play on the X Files, as you can tell from the logo. And on the back, it had I Want to Believe was on the back. There were another set of shirts printed up for a few of us that said Trust No One. Let me talk about PETA.org. PETA.org was Mike Downey's crusade, well, at least one of them at the time. Mike Downey was toward the end of 1995, 1996, 1997. He was bored. Basically, the company had grown large enough that they didn't really need Mike Downey's utility infield or skills anymore. So, you know, he sat in an office and he puttered around. So one of the things he did was register a lot of domain names, and one of the domain names that he went out and registered was PETA.org. And PETA.org was people eating tasty animals. Now, you go and read Mike's accounts of this on the website, and Mike hadn't even put up, had registered, within a week, Mike was getting hate mail from vegans. And it wasn't a very sophisticated email. It was on the form of, gee, you've bought yourself a case of hate, haven't you? PETA found out shortly thereafter, and they started suing Mike. And PETA and Mike ended up in this multi-year battle that I think was resolved in 2000 or 2001, where PETA actually did get the domain name PETA.org back into their control. But this really didn't, but you know, PETA, in my mind, they're a bunch of vegan hypocrites, because if you looked at their tactics, shortly after Mike Downey did this on the internet, they started registering parody domain names of their own. PETA's got at least over 70 domains, like Death McChicken and stuff like that, registered on the internet. And then this year they did the whole stunt where they had beef.com spoofing the American Cattlemen's Association beef.org website. Where did Digex go from there? Digex had its first IPO in 1996. It was sold to Intermediate Communication in 1997 for $150 million cash. When it was sold, it had over 600 employees. That's not really that shabby for a company that started out in somebody's basement in 1991. I think it's public record. Humphrey walked away with a deal with about $12 million cash in his pocket. Digex got ended up, once it was bought by Intermediate Communications, it got split up into a lease line association, a lease line organization, and a web server units. The web server unit was spun off in 1999, barely 2 years later, to make some more cash for Intermedia. And finally, Intermedia was sold to WorldCom for $5 billion in stock. And the ironic thing about this is that Intermediate Communications was bought so that WorldCom could get majority ownership in DigEx. Once WorldCom bought Intermedia, they threw away the pieces and just kept the web host. Just very briefly, a chains of ownership. Lease Line Group and the Server Group. DigEx was first the company, then it was bought by Intermedia, and then the pieces of DigEx that were the Lease Line Group were transferred over to Allegiance Telecom when WorldCom came in and bought Intermedia. And then as of last year, Allegiance Telecom was bought out by XO Communications. Now on the server side of the group, there was DigEx, then it was Intermedia DigEx, then DigEx was spun out as an IPO, and then WorldCom MCI acquired DigEx. DigEx is now solely MCI's property as of 2004, or as I was saying to KK, DigEx is MCI's bitch. DigEx is now, WorldCom owns 100% of DigEx's stock. You go to the DigEx.com website, you basically get directed to MCI's website. Where are they now? Doug Humphrey has his own SS7 phone switch. Life's good when you have money. And a surplus Royal Navy patrol boat that's about 100 feet long. He likes to refer to it as 100 feet of British steel. It's called the Bats Maru. It hangs out in Baltimore Harbor. Mike Downey is currently stalking what Christian cults around the country. No, literally. Mike Downey is on a crusade basically against Operation Rescue. And he's developing some operations to inform people about the risks of Operation Rescue. Ed Kern is currently a Cisco, and Dave McGuire's freelance consulting. DigEx, the book. Hopefully by fall of 2000, Vaughn Publishing will be putting out a book about DigEx history. It'll cover roughly the start of DigEx through the end of 1997 and include such things like venture capital money and the first IPO for DigEx, and then through its acquisition by Intermediate Communications. The era from 1997 through 2004 is not covered in the book being developed about DigEx. It's going to be another project. You get a very complex set of relationships and soap operas of ownership because you took DigEx, you spun off its web hosting group. Intermedia spun a lot of spun out the web hosting group, moved people in and out to run it, and then IPO'd it in 1999. And then once again, WorldCom, Bernie Ebbers, for whatever reason, really wanted the DigEx name and the DigEx web hosting group. And it really pissed off John Sidmore that Bernie Ebbers bought DigEx for like $5 billion and he didn't even talk to his number two man about buying the company. He bought it for like a premium price and ended up throwing away half of what he bought in Intermedia just to keep the web business. But then we all know what happened to Bernie. Party favor. There are pictures of the DigEx Christmas party in 1996 floating around on the internet. I did not take them. I did not post them. I'm not responsible for their content or publishing them electronically. The pictures were taken by a non-DigEx employee who was invited to the Christmas party. He's a guest with a camera. Okay, what does this tell you about, you know, guests with cameras? The pictures are posted on a website in Sweden, and the URL is publicly available somewhere on, as well as in this presentation. If you dig around, you'll find it on Orkut and Google Forum. Personal whoring, I write for Vaughn Magazine, the Inquirer website over in the UK, and mobile radio technology once in a while. The end, and I'll take questions. Questions? Yes, no, maybe? Yes. Yeah, I got to give. I got to email the presentation, and they'll put it up. So you'll be able to get that URL and look at things. Other questions? Well, if that's that, then this is it. Thank you very much for attending.